Welcome to Diva of Days of Our Lives on Blog Talk Radio. We are honored to have with us today the Artistic Director of Cape May Stage, Roy Steinberg.
Can I help you?
Roy is the director of the world premiere production of Class, starring Teo Penglis and Heather Matarazzo, running from May 14th through June 12th. He has directed episodes of All My Children, Guiding Light, and, of course, Days of Our Lives, where he also served as supervising producer. He has directed classical and contemporary plays as well as world premieres all over the United States and has performed with such luminaries as Constance Cummings, Christopher Walken, and William Hurt. Also a widely esteemed acting instructor, he has taught at such prestigious venues as NYU and UCLA as well as many others. If you have a question for Roy, please feel free to call in at 914-338-1239. So welcome, Roy. Thank you for being here.
Well, it's my great pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
Oh, well, we have so many listeners who are eagerly awaiting to see this new production of Class. We have plenty of people who love Teo Penglis as an actor, plenty of also people who love Heather Matarazzo in the day set, and we're eagerly awaiting to see this show. Can you give our listeners an idea of what they can expect to see?
Yes, well, I love them both as well. I mean, they're both actually perfect for these parts. The play, though it's called Class and takes place in an acting class, is actually about more than just an acting class. It's actually about having class, and it's about the class of celebrity. And Teo Penglis plays the character of Elliot, who is an iconic acting teacher, somebody who, like Elise Strasberg, somebody who was an important acting teacher that actors try to get into their class, and unless you're chosen, you know, only the chosen few are permitted in. And Heather Matarazzo's character is Sarah, and at first he doesn't recognize who she is. I mean, she comes on with sunglasses and a hat, and she looks like she's just some kid who wants to take a class, and he tells her there's no room, and that classes begin at the beginning of each month, and he's kind of rude to her. In the course of the play, we find out that she's actually a movie star. I know it's a big... I'm giving away a big reveal, but it's an important part of the play. And there's some very, very funny and entertaining moments where she talks about some of the other movies she's done. And, of course, they're not the kind of movies that his character would have seen, you know, like the teenage space science fiction movies and that sort of thing.
Huh?
So think of like a Lindsay Lohan, you know, going to, Lee Strasberg or someone like that. Lee Strasberg, by the way, was the guy who people think of as the guy who created method acting, you know,
yeah,
back in the 50s. So the two of them develop a kind of unlikely friendship, and they end up changing each other's lives. There's a big question and a big reveal, I should say, that happens in her character, which I won't give away for your listeners who come to see the play. He helps her with that major reveal.
Well, speaking of Lee Strasberg, that reminds me very much of, the famous story of Marilyn Monroe, who went to the Actors Studio and took classes from him. And as I remember from the biographies I've read, you know, no one took her seriously because she was always, you know, known as, you know, from
absolutely
the 7-year itch,
it's so
and gentleman
smart
with her
of you
blonde.
To say that. In fact,
yeah,
you know, the first time I met Heather Matarazzo, we arranged to meet at Starbucks in Manhattan. And one of the first things she said to me, first thing she said is, I love this play. And the second thing she said was, I think this is like Marilyn Monroe. And I said, wow, how very perceptive, because it is. I mean, she's a star, but not yet an actor. And and she wanted to learn to be an artist. And there's a difference between being a star and being an artist.
Uh-huh.
And that's what he helps her become.
Absolutely. Well, what was it about this play of Class? Was it the dynamic of the acting teacher and student that appealed to you? What made you decide to take this one on?
There were a number of things. You know, I first found out about it. I went to the Yale Drama School, and there was an alumni magazine. And there was an article in the alumni magazine that said there was this guy named Charles Everett who had a movie out called Adopt a Sailor that was getting lots of attention at the various film festivals. It starred B.B. Newworth and Peter Coyote, and it was a major kind of hit in the film circuit. And it mentioned he was from New Jersey, and it mentioned that he was in the Navy. And I thought, gee, you know, Cape May Stage is in New Jersey. We have the largest Coast Guard station, not quite the Navy, but close, you know, in the nation, in our town. And I have been an acting teacher. And so I wrote to him and said, well, what kind of what plays do you have? What kind of short plays do you have? When he sent me this play, it made me laugh, first of all. Made me laugh in recognition of some of the things that have happened to me, both as an actor and as a teacher. And then it made me cry. And I thought, well, isn't that wonderful? Something, because I read hundreds and hundreds of plays, and, you know, so few of them actually move me. You know, after a while, not that you get jaded, but, you know, you read so many things that after a while it takes something special to make you really moved. And this play was so moving and so funny that I instantly wanted to do it, and I sent him an email back saying I want to produce this play. But as it turned out, a bunch of other theaters wanted to do it also. So I invited Chuck Everett, the writer, to come to Cape May, and he and I sat, came with his wife, and I was with my daughter at the time, and we sat down and had dinner, and then we were doing a production of Proof, the Pulitzer Prize-winning play Proof, and he just loved what he saw here at the theater. He loved the city of Cape May, the town of Cape May, and that night he said, I want you guys to be the theater that does the premiere. And we're so very thankful that he chose us.
In a recent Soap Opera Digest interview that just came out this week, or is about to come out, Teo Pinglis said that you found this role perfect for him and really believed in him to take on this part. What was it about the role of the acting teacher that made you think of Teo?
Well, a number of things. First of all, Teo has been the assistant to Milton Katsalas. Milton Katsalas is a Los Angeles, he just passed away this past year, but he was a very important acting teacher in Los Angeles. He ran the Beverly Hills Playhouse for many years. And Teo, for over a decade, was his assistant. So he really understands what it is to be an acting teacher. In addition to that, he has this marvelous kind of old-school way of thinking of things. You know, I mean, the character corrects this young actress just in terms of her grammar. She keeps using the word like, and, you know, it's the kind of thing like a dad might say to his kid, you know, it's not like anything. It is. It either is or it isn't, you know. And it was the kind of thing I could hear Teo saying just in real life.
Uh-huh.
And I really enjoyed his work on Days of Our Lives. He was, he always brought something to the table. I mean, sometimes, because you do so many of these things, the writing is less than inspired, and sometimes it's marvelous, but when it is less than inspired, he could always find a way to make it pop off the screen, and that's what I loved about him. So I thought, well, if I was going to cast this, who would I think of? And Teo immediately came to mind.
Absolutely. The way you describe it, I can visualize him in this part as well. I've had the good luck to meet him a few years ago and had a few conversations with him. And yes, I'm very excited to see him in this role.
Yes, and the thing that's surprising for your listeners who only know him as Tony DiMera, and he plays a villain, they may not know how funny he is. And he's hilariously funny, both in real life. He has this hilarious wit. And this character is very funny. So it's a side of Teo that many people might not know.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, I think even during the worst of the some of the writing on Days, you know, when he would play Andre and such, he always would manage to put humor in it. Even, you know, if it was the storyline was ludicrous, I thought he often would put humor into something that could have been just so silly. I mean, I agree with you. Often he would manage to make a scene watchable when, you know, by all rights, it shouldn't have been.
Right, I know. And he's so charming. I mean, both in life and as a character on the stage, you know.
Oh,
so
yeah.
I think that was also, it was important to me when I read the play because the character, he, you know, if, in the hands of someone who is less charming, could just come off as somebody who's just mean. And I didn't want that. I wanted this character to be, you know, accepted by the audience. And immediately, as soon as I heard him read it, I knew he was right.
Uh-huh. Well, so on the other side, what about Heather Matarazzo? Did she come to mind, obviously, as a casting choice as quickly? Or
actually, no. In the case of Heather, she came to me through a friend. And the thing that I thought was so interesting about her is her character is very much like Heather's actual career. I mean, many people know her when she was much younger, when she did The Princess Diaries, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the kind of movies that this character has done. You know, she's been in teenage films and or even films like Hostel 2 and, of course, Welcome to the Dollhouse. And she's a movie star, so she's somebody who understands what it's like to be in that culture of celebrity. When I met with Heather, I realized early that she had a kind of interesting take on the character. She was the one who brought up Marilyn Monroe. She understands what it's like. In fact, even as we were sitting there having our coffee, a few people stopped by to say, we don't want to interrupt, but we just want to tell you how much we enjoyed your work in X, Y, and Z. And I thought, well, she has a special kind of understanding of this character. And she, too, has a kind of wonderful sense of humor and a kind of quirky sense of humor that's not actually immediately written in the text, but she has brought that to this production, and I'm very, very grateful for that.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, with Teo and Heather both having such a background in television and film, is it particularly challenging to direct them on for the stage?
It is, and it's very brave of both of them, actually, because the theater requires different muscles than you use in theater and television. I started in the theater and worked for many, many years, first in the theater and then later in television and then later in film. In television and film, of course, you get many takes. You know, if it doesn't work, you can just say cut and you do it again, and it's up to a director and an editor to choose the best one. In the theater, it's live. It's right in front of you. It's in our theater, it's such a lovely, tiny venue. You're only seven rows away is the furthest away you are. So there's no faking it. You know, if you either do it or you don't, and there's no take two. So it was quite brave of both of them to come and go for this ride. And to their credit, they're both marvelous in it, and I think an audience will just love seeing what they're doing.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems, you know, you had mentioned Milton Katselis, and actually I would think that a lot of Teo's fans, most of them probably have heard of him and know of him because he often, in his interviews and chats, speaks very reverently about Milton. And
right.
It's just interesting to me how everyone involved seems to have that acting teacher that was the person that creatively, you know, broke ground with them. I had read that that the playwright Charles Everett
right.
had he'd mentioned Austin Pendleton,
right?
Who I actually know of because I live in New York City by HB Studios, so I'm familiar with Austin Pendleton.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And you know, Teo has Milton Katselis, who was your influence as an acting teacher.
Well, several. I mean, the first one I worked with was a man named Alvin Epstein at Yale Drama School, and Alvin was the original Lucky in Waiting for Godot, and later directed me, and life is so interesting in this way that I ended up directing him in The Mad Woman of Chaillot. We've been friends, and he is still a mentor for me. He was the artistic director of the Guthrie in Minneapolis and co-artistic director at Yale Rep at one point. At this point, he's quite advanced in years. He just played King Lear in New York at La Mama. So he's an important actor and director who has had a great influence in my life.
Mm-hmm. We actually already have a few people in line to talk to you. So let me
bring
someone on. Area code 111, you're on the air. Hello? I don't know where they are. Let's try.
Okay.
We'll try them back later. Let's try. Hello, Meg.
Hi.
Hi. Hi, Meg.
Hello, Roy. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
I have a quick question for you, since I'm going to see class in a few weeks. Do you find it easier to direct two actors instead of a whole cast of 12 or more? And what types of challenges do you face with each?
That's a good question. There's different challenges with every play. You know, with a two-hander, the actors are on stage nearly all of the time, and so the challenge is, of course, to keep it visually interesting as a director so that it's only the patterns are always going to be just two people. when you have more people, there's more opportunity to break up the visual patterns. And of course, with more people, I mean, I've directed, for example, Othello, which has, quite a number of people on the stage, and then it's just keeping track of all the various subplots and stories and trying to make them all specific. This group they're a terrific couple, and they've bonded both personally as well as on the stage, so there's a great kind of connection, which was important to me to create that for this production. And I'll look forward to meeting you when you come to the theater.
Oh, thank you very much, and thank you for answering my question.
You're very welcome.
Have a wonderful day. Thank you, Diva.
Okay, bye.
Thank you. Thanks for calling in. So how long have you been the artistic director of Cape May Stage?
I just started last year. Last year was my first year, and it was an experiment in my own life. You know, I mean, I was living in Los Angeles, and a friend of mine sent me an email with the ad saying they were looking for an artistic director, and the email said, "This sounds like you." And I frankly didn't really think much of it, but, you know, you can just, these days, you just click a mouse and your resume goes out, and they called me, and I started to talk to the people who were running the theater, the board, and I found them to be such an interesting group. And I thought to myself, you know, if I ever wanted to start a theater, first of all, I would look for a place that had sophisticated people who, you know, who would do the kinds of work that I want to do, and secondly, have the means to do it. And Cape May had both of those ingredients. I mean, a board of very committed, active people, many of whom live in many places. They'll live part of the time in the Bahamas or Florida or someplace else, and then they live in Cape May part of the time, or even the upstate New York. And they also have the financial commitment to take this church that was kind of falling apart, and about 2 years ago they spent nearly $2 million renovating it and turning it into a jewel box of a theater. So when you come to Cape May, people are just, you know, blown away by how beautiful the theater itself is. I mean, it sounds funny, but even the bathrooms, this is a funny story, but there was somebody in town who has a marble company, and so when they asked for funding to renovate this theater, they said, "Well, we don't have the cash to, but we would love to give you the marble for the bathrooms, so we have bathrooms that are nicer than any Broadway theater I've been in."
Well, that sounds great. Well, how do you decide to choose what shows are going to come up during the season? Do you choose, like, artistically, or are you thinking strictly business sense in terms of...
Well, both. I mean, this when you're thinking of a season, I try to think of it like I would plan a meal. You know, you have an appetizer, and you have the main course, and you have dessert. And, of course, you know, we're just a block from the beach, this glorious beach. So during the summertime, I don't want anything too heavy. You want to do things that are fun and entertaining. And then as it gets a little cooler in September, I introduce plays that have a little bit more substance. So last year, for example, my first season, we started for the first time ever with a play that had music called Souvenir, and brought in all of the plays on Cape May Stage since I've come have Broadway veterans in them. Heather, by the way, was on Broadway in The Women, this play that we're doing.
Uh-huh.
And so all of our productions have either people from Broadway or from feature films and Hollywood.
Uh-huh.
And so we've really kind of raised the bar from where it had been previously. But to answer your question about how we choose the season, I would want a combination of plays that are light and funny and then romantic and then plays that challenge you intellectually. And this year we're doing a Nobel Prize winning playwright, Samuel Beckett.
Uh-huh.
And we're bringing Lynn Cohn, who's in Sex and the City, to play the role of Winnie in that production. And we're also doing a Pulitzer Prize winning play called Top Dog Underdog, which is also involved in it is a man that your listeners may know from Days of Our Lives, James Reynolds.
Yes.
Who is an Emmy nominee as well, two-time Emmy
nominee. I was just going to ask you about that, if you were involved with And Where She Stops, Nobody Knows. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, he's going to be coming here twice. First, he's going to be doing And Where She Stops, Nobody Knows in July. That's a one-time only on a Monday night around July 5th, I believe it is. And in addition to that, he is coming back later in the season to direct Top Dog Underdog, which will begin in Los Angeles and then travel to Cape May.
Mm-hmm.
He has a theater called the Fremont Theater Center in Pasadena, South Pasadena. And Teo and James Reynolds are, you know, two of my favorite people from Days of Our Lives. And so the nice thing about having your own theater is you get to choose who you want to work with.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's exciting for the fans that live up in the Northeast because, you know, yeah, I'm familiar with James Reynolds Theater, but yes, it's hard for people to get to L.A. often to
right.
go to all these different shows. So it's cool that, you know, they're accessible over here for a change, and we can you know, like for me, Cape May is only, you know, a couple of hours away. So
right.
I'm excited to do that. Well, I want to switch to Days just for a second, for a little bit. I'm just curious because you are the first director of from the soap opera world that I've had a chance to interview, and I'm just wondering what you have a reputation as an actor's director, and I know that, you know, when you're filming a soap opera, you're under so much time constraint, barely any rehearsal. How do you get the performances you want out of the actors when you're working under such an intense time constraint?
That's a great question. You know, it's funny, when I first started directing daytime, I come from the theater, and I'll tell you, this: the way it first started was the executive producer of Guiding Light at the time saw a play I directed and invited me to come direct Guiding Light. And coming from the theater, it was just a normal thing for me to tell an actor, just remember, you know, you've just done this before, you know, and you're about to do that. And of course, because you're under such time constraints, very few directors do that in daytime television. You know, they usually just say, you stand over there and there's a two shot, you walk over here and somebody slaps you, you walk out here, okay, 5-4-3 and cue action, and you know, and you can earn your off. And I love talking with actors, and I love talking about what their motivation is, and I almost never give a direction like just cross left. I'll ask somebody to cross left because of something. So it's always motivated from a character point of view. So I had a wonderful time. I was on Guiding Light for 10 years, and both as a director and producer, and then worked, actually I went over to One Life to Live for a bit as well. And then when I was on Days, I brought that same kind of background to talk to actors. But you're right, there is enormous pressure to finish the day quickly, and so a lot of the time, and of course, you know, the actors on daytime know their characters. They've been playing them for, you know, sometimes 25 years, in the case of someone like Deidre Hall. So I don't need to tell Deidre Hall how to play, you know, Marlena. But I could still help her, if she asked for it, giving her, for example, when she was having amnesia. You know, at one point I actually did talk with her. I did a play on Broadway called Wings, which was about a woman who had a stroke. And so I remember I did actually speak to her a little bit about what aphasia is and how, you know, everybody can forget somebody's name once in a while and then it pops into your brain, and what that experience is like. And so sometimes, you know, you look at something for an instant, you don't even know what it is, and that's what stroke patients deal with. So when we were dealing with her amnesia, which is, you know, a soap opera disease that happens all the time, I tried to make it something that was not just a silly soap opera disease, but something that has some kind of basis in reality. And I try to do that with everything I do. I try to base, even if it's a comedy that's just broad comedy, I try to base it on something that's real.
Uh-huh. Well, just reminds me, you know, from the years that you were involved on Days of Our Lives as director and as producer, that those were some crazy times because there were so many turnovers of head writers.
That's
and,
right.
Of course, James Riley came back the second time, and I was just curious, you know, James Riley, during his second time, well, both times, actually, but during the second time especially, he wrote some crazy over-the-top stuff.
Yeah, he sure
and
did.
And I'm just
yeah.
wondering, was there ever anything that was just so hard, that you were just stumped as how to direct it?
Well, sure, yeah. I mean, you know, the funny thing is, when you're a producer, you sit in story meetings and you know what's coming up, and sometimes, you know, you're in those meetings and you're saying, oh, you know, this doesn't make any sense, or why are we doing that? And then we, you know, we fight about it and try to, you know, change it and fix it or whatever. And then either it did or it didn't get changed or fixed, and then you're down on the floor shooting it, and now it's your job to sell it. So
right.
You have to make it work.
Uh-huh.
And so sometimes the very thing that you were fighting about, you know, 6 weeks earlier is now it's your job to make it work, and so you find a way to justify it.
Uh-huh.
And no matter how outlandish something is, you know, sometimes you read the newspaper and you think, this is nuts. How could this be? And yet it is. You know, you read things that really stretch your credulity, and you think, my God. And yet it really happened. So I always try to put myself in that circumstance of saying, well, someone did do something like this somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you make that work?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, we're always hearing about with the actors not really knowing sometimes where, not knowing where the character is going to go, because they only
right.
get, you know, the scripts as they go along. As a director, do you have any more of an idea of future storyline of how to go about directing something, or do you just have to go day by day as well?
I know a little bit more. I mean, as a producer more than as a director, and again, it depends on the show, but you have what we sometimes call the long-term story document or a Bible, and so you do know sometimes, depending upon the show, of course, that a year from now that this character is going to do X, Y, or Z, or break up with somebody, or, you know, marry somebody. So you can start laying in, you know, little teeny hints as a director.
Uh-huh.
But because things change, the difference between the theater is you read the whole play, and, you know what's going to happen in Act 3, so you can lay little foundations in Act 1 or in Act 2 and let it pay off in Act 3. But in daytime, which goes on for years, if you're lucky these days, years, you don't know, and so you can only play what you know at this moment with some knowledge of what's going to happen in the future.
Uh-huh.
But I remember, I know I was an actor on Another World back in the 80s. I played a doctor called Dr. Longo. And one day I came in, picked up a script, and I saw on the script it said Mrs. Longo. And I said, oh, my God, I'm married? I said, I wish I'd known that. I would have worn a wedding ring all these rest of the last 8 months I was doing this thing, you know. And the writers had thought up, they wanted to do something to make my character mad, and so this other character ran over my wife, you know. And so I had to then instantly come have a relationship with this character that I just found out about.
Yeah, I mean, I must think it's crazy. I mean, even with Teo and Tony and Andre, it's like I don't know how he could have known half the time who he was playing, because they'd change this, you know, they'd change his character
right.
every 5 years.
That's right, depending upon who the head writer is. I mean, when
yeah.
I first came to Days of Our Lives, we had Paula Swickley and Peter, what's his last name for a moment, Brash, Peter Brash. And and actually, we were number one for quite a while without those head writers, and then for whatever reason it changed, and they brought in a different head writer, and that changed, and they brought in Jim Riley, and it changed again. You know, so it's every head writer has a different sensibility and wants to tell different stories.
I have a question from the chat room about someone wanting to know if you had any memories about Frances Reed that you'd care to share.
Oh, yes, I do. I love Frances Reed. when I first met her, she was in the makeup room, and she was holding a script, and she said something like, this doesn't make any sense. Do you read these things? And jokingly, I just said, no, I find it only confuses me. I try never to read it. And she said, okay, you're going to be okay. And she was a very funny and delightful actor to work with. And I'm sure we all miss her very much.
Uh-huh. Well, we have another caller on the line. Hold on one moment. 718 area code.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, this is Matthew.
Hello, Matthew.
Hi, Roy. How are you? First of all, I am delighted to hear that you're doing plays like Proof and Top Dog Underdog, as well as the new, I mean, Three Cheers for the New Pieces, of course, but I live in New York City, and I remember vividly when those plays were on Broadway and when they both won the Pulitzer. And I wanted to ask, is James Reynolds going to be in Top Dog Underdog, or is he only directing it?
He's only directing it.
Okay.
He will be in the other play that he's doing, The One Night Only, on July 5th. So he'll be in Cape May performing on July 5th, and then he comes back to just direct Top Dog Underdog.
Now, you've been working as both an actor and a director. Have you ever had the occasion to direct yourself in a piece? Have you ever pulled an Olivier that way?
No, I haven't. I've always been directed by someone else. I'm too chicken to do. I always think I feel like I need someone to keep me honest.
You need that objectivity.
Yes.
One more question, if I may. I loved what you guys mentioned at the beginning of the interview about the Marilyn Monroe Lee Strasberg comparison. But Marilyn Monroe is, I think, I've always considered her one of those tremendously underrated actors, you know, overrated perhaps as a star, but the fact that she was a great artist was not really fully appreciated even by herself, it seems.
That's right.
And in a way, that often tends to be true of soap actors as well, you know, whether it's Teo Panglis or Matt Ashford or Deidre Hall or whatnot. You always hear this stigma from a lot of people who appreciate the legit stage and classic movies and whatnot. Oh, well, there's the great actors, and then there's the soap actors. And then you hear an interview like this, and you hear about all the stage work that they're doing and all the classical training that they have and whatnot. What advice do you give to, you know, young soap actors who are looking to be taken more seriously in a wider field?
Well, I would say if you're a young soap actor, is to do something else as well. I mean, to do some theater, do a film, you know, just expand your horizon. I mean, the hard part is if you're under contract, of course, you can't get away very much, and that's why people like Julianne Moore is a good example. You know, she was in As the World Turns, and then she, after, I don't know, maybe it was 2 or 3 years, she left doing World Turns and started doing film work and, you know, and did some, you know, extraordinary work in features. A great many actors who began in daytime at some point go off and then do something else. But as I say, it's difficult, you know, if you're under contract because you're working all the time.
And it's
if you're doing
to
a film,
they
need you on location.
Yeah. Yeah. All righty, excellent. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So I'm also curious, Ken Corday's book has come out this week. Have you read it?
I haven't had a chance. I intend to at some point.
Yeah.
But, you know, I have worked with Ken Corday not just on Days of Our Lives, but I have another show. I'm the executive producer of a show called Longitude, which is I'm co-executive producers with Ken Corday and Albert Allar, who is still a director on Days of Our Lives. And we actually shot that at NBC in Los Angeles, and we're hoping to launch it as a web series.
Yes. Well, that leads me to a question. Do you so many web series are starting to come up, especially along the soap lines. We have Gotham and Venice and Reality Bites with Drake Hogeston is going to be coming, and Martha Madison just got on that show as well. Do you think that web series are really becoming sort of the wave of the future?
I do. I think that the big problem so far, and I'm sure it'll get solved eventually, is how anybody can make any real money doing it. I mean, at the moment, nobody's really figured out the model to make any serious money. And the only reason I mention that is that in order to, you know, pay for production values and pay the actors and so that they can live, there needs to be some kind of model where, whether it's through advertising or through subscriptions or through product placement or whatever it's going to be, there's some way to market the work. In fact, Longitude was started about 3 years ago, and Albert and Ken and I came up with an idea of how to do that. And maybe we're just a little ahead of the curve, and maybe now's the time to do it.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you think that the internet is partly responsible for why soap opera ratings are getting so much lower and the soaps are in so much trouble?
I think there's a number of things. That's one of them. I mean, you know, I'm not the first to look at what just happened in the world. I mean, back when soaps were much more popular in terms of viewers. The women were at home. You know, they were. The cliche was that the woman was ironing and, you know, and watching her favorite show. Well, women are in the workplace. Besides broadcast television, there's cable, and besides cable, there's the internet. And our lives are so much busier these days that unless you make a real effort, you know, to either TiVo it or, you know, record it in some way, it's hard for many people to actually watch their shows. They're working.
Mm-hmm.
And the model of soaps is an old model. I mean, you have 30 or 40 people under contract that you don't use in many cases, so you're paying people that you're not using. You have to move sets from, at least in New York, usually you have to store them somewhere else and then truck them in, which is very expensive, and, you know, take them down, put them up, change lighting for every, you know, every day or so. It's a very expensive way to do things, which is why I think reality shows, for example, they're much cheaper to produce, and even if they don't work, you can throw another one up there and see if one does. And I think that's partly what's happened to daytime.
Huh. Well,
I was going to say there's so many people who are under salary, people you don't see on the screen, but there's writers and carpenters and electricians and people who just deal with the greens. If it's an outdoor set, you know, who does all the trees and the flowers and you know, the production assistants and associate directors and technical directors. I mean, all these, you know, video engineers. There are all kinds of people that are needed to make a daytime serial.
Mm-hmm. I have a question from the chat room. Could you give us an idea of what Longitude is about?
What Longitude is about, yes. Longitude is about a club. These three guys who want to open a music club. And one of them has, in his family, there's an old abandoned warehouse, and the back taxes are owed, but if they can just get the money to pay the back taxes, they can open up this club. And they do. They get the money to get the back taxes. One character is Latino, one character is African-American, one character is Caucasian. The Latino guy's family comes up with the money. Someone burns the club down, and there's a number of people who have a reason to burn the club down. We had the Oolahs, who were a group that played in, I believe it was the first Spider-Man movie, that were performing for us in the first production, the first Longitude. And this could also be a kind of a game we were thinking of, that who burned the club down. And the Longitude is the name of the club. It's like lounge and attitude. So the idea was that every week we would have a different band with these same characters, and the characters get involved very much like a soap. I mean, two characters are in love with the same woman, and there's a brother who's kind of a bad guy who gets in trouble with his brother, and, you know, there's all sorts of stuff that goes on.
Mm-hmm. So it's sort of in the pilot stages now, or
exactly? Yeah, we shot a pilot.
Uh-huh. Well, good luck with that. You know,
well, thank you. Yeah,
seems
we're
like everything
by it.
Is getting more and more, you know, towards the web series. So hopefully, it will make its way out there.
Yes, we're thrilled with the way we did it. We shot it very quickly, and people can't believe how great it looks. Sony gave us they call these Sony 900 cameras in high definition. So we actually shot it in high definition, which you can't see on the web, but if we were to broadcast it, it looks like a feature film.
Uh-huh.
It's beautiful.
Wow. Yeah, because you have so much more also, you know, creative freedom, I suppose, with doing a web series. You're not having
right.
You know, Sony and NBC, et cetera, you know, telling you what to spend your money on. And, you know,
exactly.
All that. So, yeah, that would strike me as a real appeal to doing a web show.
Right.
Yeah. So what, here's another question, sort of a random question. Do you have a favorite Days storyline that you worked on?
That's interesting. Well, I liked when Marlena was getting sprung from jail and the helicopters came in and, you know, we had to, I think that storyline was kind of fun.
Oh, yeah, the Salem serial
yeah.
killer storyline?
Yeah,
that was... well, as a viewer, I was I loved Matt Ashford and I loved Teo Penglis, and when they both got killed off, I wasn't too pleased.
Yeah, no, we,
but it was a thing where I watched every day.
Right. But it was fun to see Deidre in jail and getting her sprung. And I actually directed some of that stuff, which was great fun for me, the rooftop where she would have, the helicopter was coming down and all that kind of stuff. That was great.
Well, I always thought that the acting was great. Yeah, it was it was just the choice of victims I didn't like, but the acting was always great.
Right.
And I just, since you were there, I just want to ask, did NBC, was the original plan to really have all those characters remain dead, or was it always in the plan to bring them back on the island?
I honestly don't know. I mean, I learned it when I was on vacation, actually. In my mind, I thought they were dead, the characters. And, in fact, the crew was all told, because around that time, they were trying to save money. And some people thought, well, they were killing all these characters off to save money. And the crew was also asked to take pay cuts. And then I believe it was in April, they announced to the crew that they were all coming back, which was a shock to everybody. And I was away. I think I was in Palm Springs at the time. And someone called me to say, guess what? I said, oh, my God, really? I don't really honestly don't know the background to that, if Jim Riley always had that in the back of his mind, or if Ken, after the fact, said, I can't bear to have them all gone. I don't know what the story was.
Well, I think, just as a viewer, once Alice Horton started to eat the poison donuts, we're all like, okay, this can't be really happening.
Right, right.
It was just too whacked out by that point.
Right, exactly.
Well, I don't know if you're keeping up with Days of Our Lives so much after you left working for the show, but in 2009, obviously the recession really hit them hard. They had to go under the major budget cuts, and of course they let Teo go along with Deidre and Drake and Mary Beth Evans and Stephen Nichols, and so many people thought, okay, this is the end of Days. They can't let go of all these vets and still keep going. And to a lot of people's surprise, they got a renewal and their ratings even rose for a little while. Why do you think that those changes worked?
No, I don't know. I have not been watching it since I left, I have to say. I think good story, though, is good story. I mean, if there is a story that's compelling, people will watch it.
Uh-huh.
And I think it's really, in the end, as simple as that.
Yeah.
So as much as there are beloved characters, and a good writer will take the beloved characters and create story for them, you can take beloved characters and put them in something that's not interesting, and the ratings go down.
Chat room question I have. How do you feel about the cancellation of Guiding Light?
Oh, it was sad. I mean, I was happy that it was able to last as long as it did. It had been rumored to have been canceled. I've been hearing rumors for the last 10 years that it was getting canceled. It didn't surprise me that they were getting canceled. I mean, just looking at the numbers. But it was sad. I mean, it was the longest running show in history. I mean, it began in 1937 on the radio and then moved to television in 1952. And, that in and of itself is extraordinary.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, one thing I learned reading Ken Corday's book is that Ted and Betty, well, at least Ted Corday was involved with Guiding Light World Turns and Days of Our Lives. And now two of them were gone.
Right.
So it's kind of a sad situation seeing the longest running shows being some of the first ones to go,
Right.
What was the most challenging storyline that you have had to direct?
I think the island was the most challenging. It was so, just technically, we had that force field wall, and it just involved all kinds of, what we call locked off cameras, so that you had to do a great deal of post-production. I must say, I wasn't a great fan of the island story, just personally. And then directing it, I had to try to figure out ways to try to make it at least watchable. sometimes it was hard to make that really sell that.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it was hard to watch sometimes because it's just so.
I mean, the things that I love, you know, in daytime and in the theater for that matter, are stories about people.
Yes.
I mean, for me, it's not about special effects so much. I mean, I appreciate them, but I think the theater is a place where you go to try on somebody else's life. You know, you think, well, what would happen if I was lived in a circumstance like that? And I think the same thing is true in daytime. I think my favorite story of all was when on Guiding Light, when Tina Sloan, Lillian, discovered she had breast cancer. And what I thought was so good about it was we told a story in real time, a story that affects many, many women, and we told it in a very responsible way and in a way that I think gave people hope because the character went through the very things that women do at home. You know, she first discovered a lump and she had to make decisions about, what kind of treatment to do and whether to tell anybody and feelings of shame and embarrassment and all kinds of other. And I mean, Tina was a wonderful, wonderful artist. And in fact, she was at Cape May Stage last year.
Ah.
Tina called me when she heard I was here at Cape May Stage and said she'd written a play called Changing Shoes, which was about her life as an actor. The title refers to when she was young, she wore these stilettos, and she in her play she talks about how she could men were like looking at her when she walked into her room, and as she got older, she realized that they were looking past her to the next young thing who was wearing high heels, and she was wearing flats. and it was a very wise and funny and charming as she is, kind of exploration of what it is to grow older with grace.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I've always found the character storylines. Well, that's what so many people say now about the soap operas. So many people would rather see the character-driven stories as opposed to plot-driven.
Absolutely.
Yeah, if it gets too plot-driven, then the characters all sort of become flat and cartoonish sometimes.
That's right.
Or stereotypical. Yeah, so I have another question in the chat room about Guiding Light. Did you like the new filming style they did near the end with the handheld cameras outside, if you were familiar, if you saw that?
Yeah, no, I did not. I appreciated what Ellen did, the executive producer did, and I thought it was groundbreaking, and I applaud her for, first of all, trying to just make the show survive, and they had to do something because it was going to go off the air. And I think that was a good attempt. In the end, I didn't think it looked very good, and it didn't make the characters look very good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so much. I remember when Ed Scott went on Days, and he really made the sets look great, and that's when you started to realize, the value of what you're seeing on the screen, because sometimes I just shrug it off and say, I don't care what set on as long as,
right.
That. So let's see. Okay, here is a random question. Do you prefer acting or directing?
I love them both. They're totally different things. You know, I mean, when you're an actor, you're only responsible for what your character's doing, and in some ways it's a great kind of luxury to just think about your character and what you want to accomplish in a scene or in a play. I like directing because it's like being a painter. You get to do the whole painting. You know, as an actor, you're a color. You know, you're the yellow in the painting, and as a director, you get to compose the structure and create the whole picture. And it's fun to kind of be in charge of all of that. That's what I like about producing also. I have to put things together.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a great analogy. Because I guess a writer, I can appreciate when I'm writing for different characters. I get to experience what each character feels as opposed to just, one coming
right,
just from
exactly.
One viewpoint. You, as a director, you get to feel all the viewpoints, and it's got to make it, more fun in a way.
Right.
You know?
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah. One more question: would you consider to go back to soaps ever, or are you pretty much married to the theater now?
I love doing the theater. I'm still interested in doing film and television, and continue to do film and television. Not necessarily daytime. I think daytime is waning. I never say never to anything, but my interest is not so much in daytime at the moment. It's more involved in telling stories that interest me, that are, you know, would be that would, like the story that I just mentioned, like for example the breast cancer story that Tina Sloan did. If there was something like that, I'd be interested in you know, talking to anybody about anything.
Uh-huh.
I also love being in Cape May, and I mean it's such a beautiful town. I'm talking to you, I'm looking out the window, and there's the ocean right there. It's kind of beautiful.
That's great. I look out my window, I see a brick wall over here. I'm going to Cape May to see the show, so I am very much looking forward to seeing the beautiful beaches and the beautiful. I've seen some pictures, and it looks like a beautiful place.
Yeah, I mean, Forbes magazine, I think it was Forbes, called it one of the 10 most beautiful towns in America.
Oh.
And it's all Victorian. I mean, even the hardware store says, like, since 18-something or other. It's really fun.
I think you kind of answered this question with Deidre Hall, but I'll go into it more. Are you a hands-on or hands-off director? Do you pretty much believe in letting the actors make their own choices for the most part, or do you just – how do you approach
that? Well, I'm a collaborative director. I mean, I have ideas for characters. If it's something like – I mean, as I said before, I don't need to tell Deidre Hall how to play Marlena. I mean, she certainly knows the character better than anybody, having played it for so long. Mm-hmm. When I'm working with on a play, I shape the interpretation. I mean, for example, in Class, Heather, when she first came in, had a different idea of who the character was, and I gently but nudged her in a slightly different direction, and now she really loves the direction that we're going in.
Uh-huh. Wonderful. Here's another caller. I think it's our same one caller. We'll see if she can get on this time. Hello, 111 area code. You're on the air. Hello?
Hello, 012. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes. First of all, I want to thank you for doing this interview. I find it very interesting and entertaining.
Great.
And my question is, you have already said that you have seen some of Heather's previous work to or Welcome to the Dollhouse, and you've also worked with Taylor before. So is that something you always do before you cast an actor, that you get familiar with their work in the past?
No, I don't always cast people with whom I've worked before. Many times I've worked with people for the very first time. In fact, the next play we're doing after Class is a play called I Hate Hamlet, which is a very funny play by Paul Rudnick. And some of the people are people with whom I've worked before, and most of them are not. David Burney, for example, is playing the ghost of Barrymore. He was married to Meredith Baxter Burney. You may remember, some of your listeners may remember. He was, you know, TV, and he's a great theater actor. He's done, you know, every major Shakespearean role out there. My wife, Marlena Lustig, who is a Broadway veteran, I've directed previously. Anne Hathaway's mother, Kate Hathaway, is in the production. And I have not worked with her before, but just knowing her, I think that she's perfect for the part that she's playing, a real estate agent, very, very funny part. And the man who's playing Andrew Raleigh, who's this TV actor who is going to be playing Hamlet, is someone with whom I'd never been acquainted, but his work was, you know, is revered by a number of people. His name is John Patrick Hayden. In fact, I just got an email from someone who knows his work from another theater, and when they called that theater and they said he wasn't there, she's coming to Cape May to see him here, because she follows him wherever he goes, because he's such a wonderful actor. So we're getting people from, you know, so from all over the place. Some I've known and some I have not known.
Oh, great. Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you for calling. Okay, we only have like 5 minutes left, but there are a few random questions from the chat room I guess I'll throw at you before we go.
Okay, great.
Let's see. Do you do? Oh, she just asked that question. Never mind. Is there a classic play that you would most like to direct that you haven't had a chance to direct so far?
At some point, I think I'd like to do Lear.
Ah.
I actually played Lear. I was much too young to do it, but I played it in Kentucky, and it was like my first stab at it, but I have ideas about it that I'd like to play with.
Uh-huh.
And it's such a huge canvas, you know, it has that talks about so many different elements that I think it would be really interesting to tackle it.
Of all the shows, plays, films, et cetera, about show business, which one is the most accurate? That's kind of a...
That's a good question.
A thought-provoking question there.
Yeah, it's a thought-provoking question. You know, all the ones that I know of actually have lots of elements of truth. I mean, you know, you take something, I'm trying to think, like the Royal Family, for example, or Noises Off, you know, which is very, very funny, but a lot of that stuff is very true.
Uh-huh.
I don't know that I have one that I think is the most.
Yeah. Oh.
Although, you know, I directed something that's online right now. It's called Life in General, and it was during the writer's strike. If you go to strike.tv and scroll down to Life in General, it was written by Karen Harris, who is one of the writers for General Hospital, and it's backstage at a fictional soap opera called Greenville General. And that is so accurate about what is happening backstage at in terms of a daytime show. And it's got a great cast. We have Jo Beth Williams, Academy Award winner, playing the head of a network. Lots of actors you'll recognize from General Hospital and Days of Our Lives. In fact, Ariane Zucker, who plays Nicole, plays the writer on it.
Oh, there you go.
It's a great cast. So go. So you know, if you have a moment, go to strike.tv and go to Life in General. And I think that might be the one, at least just because I'm so familiar with it, that I think is the most accurate.
Oh, wow. Well, I will definitely put a shout-out out there on our blog about it because I'm sure we will have people not only wanting to see about the soap world, but to see Ariane Zucker in it.
Yes.
And
in fact, she was nominated for a Spirit Award.
Oh, really? Well, how did I not know that? I need to get more of my game about the Spirit Awards.
Yeah.
Wow.
And that was a good example because I really worked with Ariane a lot on creating that character.
Uh-huh.
And she uses a Southern accent, and you know, we completely changed her from who she is and really came up with a character.
Oh, well, that would be fabulous. I'd love to see her play some, you know, I mean, I love Nicole, you know, her character is Nicole, but it would be fun to see her play a totally different character because we don't get a chance to see that much, you know.
Right.
I'm always amazed at how the soap actors, I had the chance to see Charles Shaughnessy in Sleuth last year, and he just blew me away. And, you know, obviously when you watch the soap operas, you think of them often as, you know, the soap characters they play, and you have no idea what they're capable of doing until you see them in the other shows, and it always impresses me. Well, you know what? We are at the end of our show now. Thank you so much for agreeing to do this interview with us, and I've learned quite a lot about.
Great. Well, it's my great pleasure, and I'm so happy to talk with you and tell you about Kate Maystage.
Oh, well, I have several friends of mine. They're going to be going. I'm going to be going twice to Journeys and
Great.
To
now,
and
just
to
class. In the last moment, let me just tell you that your listeners can go to katemaystage.com and find out all about it or call 609-884-1341, and we can help people if they want to see class or anything else at Kate Maystage.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Roy, and thank
You're
everyone
very welcome,
for listening.
Laurie, I'll say goodbye now.
Bye-bye.